Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM.
Hello, and welcome to Alaska Edition from Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Ellen Lockyer. With the budget on everyone's minds this week, we're talking jobs. How many are out there for Alaskans and who's getting them? Last week, the State Department of Labor released a report indicating that out-of-state hires are on the rise in Alaska job market. That means Alaska-based companies or organizations that do business here may not be hiring a fair percentage of Alaska residents. We'll be talking about this trend and some of the reasons behind it on our show today. But first, let's introduce our guests. Rebecca Logan is the general manager of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, commonly called the Alliance, and that represents oil and gas field service companies all over the state. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you.
And attorney Renee Sade will address why local hire laws have difficulty standing up in court. Hi, Renee.
Hello, Ellen.
Thanks for being with us. And I should say at this point that we have invited Labor Commissioner Heidi Dreigast to the show. She has turned down our invitation. So saying that, I would like to show you a quote from the report by Heidi Dreigast. And she says here that the report highlights the need for Alaska hire and that it is exactly what we are focused on. And reversing the growth in non-resident hire won't be easy. And we will do everything in our power to promote Alaska Hire. And that's from the 2014 Non-Residents Working in Alaska study, which can be found on the state webpage on the labor page. So obviously it's not going to be easy changing a trend that apparently, according to the report, has been going on for 4 or 5 years now. Although I must say that the data in the report is through 2014. So changing a trend, if the trend even exists, is not going to be simple. And Rebecca, let's start with you. First of all, tell us a little bit about the Alliance.
Sure.
What do they do?
The Alliance is a trade association that has been around for 38 years now, and they represent the support companies in oil, gas, and mining. So the producing companies like the BPs, Exxons, ConocoPhillips are not allowed to be members of our organizations. It's truly a support company organization. So those companies in the state of Alaska that provide support to oil, gas, and mining.
And what kind of jobs are we talking about? I'm understanding
it's
everything.
Such a wide range. Right. You know, really every business in the state of Alaska is in the support business for those industries because they dominate. But, you know, from engineers and architects to drillers to the hotels, the banks, a lot of promotional companies who do work for the producing companies. It's really a wide variety of jobs.
Consulting, cleaning.
Absolutely.
Everything.
Yes. Camp services.
Camp services.
All
cooking.
Kinds of stuff.
Catering. Truly, how many people do you
think
you represent?
Well, right now we have about 680 members, and they employ about 30,000 people in the state of Alaska.
30,000. That's a lot.
It's a significant number.
You would think with the widespread differences in occupations that it would provide, these kind of services would provide a huge opportunity for employment.
Absolutely.
For Alaskans and others. So, again, this 2014 non-resident workers in Alaska study indicates that maybe 35% of oil and gas workers engaged in extraction are not residents, and that the number of oil field services employees who are not residents of the state is on the rise, although the percentages are not really set. I think it's at 11%. Don't quote me on that. Would you agree with this assessment, Rebecca?
Well, I always have to, whenever I look at the Department of Labor reports, I always look at the qualifiers that they have on there. And in every report that they produce, they always give a pretty good description of where they could have errors. And there's significant opportunity for error because they only have a limited number of data available to them. So they point out, especially in this report, that they might double count people who move from company to company. They have no way not to do that. But with regard to the percentage, historically in the oil and gas industry, we've had between a 30 and 35% non-resident hire rate for at least 10 years. So it's not a new thing. And then I look at what at the year 2014 and look at what the conditions were. For 9 months of that year, we had oil over $100 a barrel. North Dakota was booming, and at least 60 of our member companies were working in North Dakota also. So they had employees here, and they had operations there.
Right.
And the state in as a whole was really booming. And then we always have to factor in the sad fact that our members traditionally have people fail. 30% of the people who apply to them for work fail pre-employment screening tests.
We'll get hold that thought.
Yes.
Well, let's show a chart. This is, again, from the report. That it's a graphic that shows, it's a pie chart. It shows the different sectors of our state industries and the percentages of non-resident. And those larger slices of the pie are some of the industries we're talking about. But I want to make it clear, the report does not target any specific industry. In fact, the seafood industry hires something like 65% out-of-state workers. They are the highest hire of non-residents. And there's reasons for that, too. And also, the seasonal factors in. So I'd like to say again, the report, does not target any one industry. It covers construction, oil and gas, field services, oil and gas extraction, tourism, hotel. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, air transportation. A lot of young pilots come up here to gain hours in the summer, and that's why they're here to begin with. So now the Walker administration last year restored the Alaska hire requirements, and apparently that allows the state to insist on 90% Alaska resident hire for state projects. So let's bring Renee into this. First of all, what's your knowledge of Alaska hire laws? Can you sort of thumbnail it for us who are not in the legal business?
Sure. Well, there's been a long history here in Alaska dating back to the late 1970s where there was an Alaska preference imposed that companies operating here in Alaska would have to give a preference to similarly situated candidates. If you had two candidates with the same qualifications, one was an Alaska resident, one was not, you were required under Alaska law to give preference to that Alaska resident. And at the time when it was first adopted, the law also required that the residency requirement was that a person had to live here 1 year to qualify for the Alaska preference. That case, though, was challenged here at the Supreme Court level, and the one-year residency requirement was struck down. Then the people who challenged that law took it all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court determined that having an Alaska local hire preference was unconstitutional, that it violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, which basically boils down to it's not fair to give residents of one state more protection or more rights than residents of another state. Right. And so taking a step back, Alaska still wanted to try to encourage all of the new employers that were coming into the state for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and encourage them to hire locals. So the law was rewritten in 1986, and at that time the law was narrowed to only address public contracts so that it was not as overreaching or broad as the U.S. Supreme Court considered the last law. Mm-hmm. And it also more narrowly defined it to say, in order to trigger this Alaska hiring preference, you also had to establish that at the current time, the zone in which the work would be done was experiencing distressed economical conditions or, at the very least, underemployment, really high rates of unemployment. And so if those two factors are in place under the existing law that was adopted in 1986, or it was proposed in 1986, I think adopted in 1987, mm-hmm. and you're dealing with a public contract or any contract that or project that is receiving public funds, you have to have a 90% Alaska hire. And so there's still some challenges out there to that law, and people, obviously, all the commentary that comes along with it. But currently, there is a law in the books. It's gone through ups and downs. The Purnell administration scaled it back and said at the time, in 2013, they determined that Anchorage and Kenai and Juneau and Matsu Valley were not in economic distress, that they weren't underemployment. So at that time, the law was kind of gutted and only applied to rural areas of Alaska. But now, as you mentioned, the Walker administration has kind of put some meat back onto them.
So is the Alaska's, excuse me, I'm stepping on your comment there. Is Alaska's hire requirement based on economic deprivation in certain areas of the state? Is there a trigger that says, well, we have so few jobs in, say, southwestern Alaska is difficult? Would that be a trigger?
Yeah, no, the statute, it's Alaska Statute 36, 10, 150, and 160, and it goes through and defines what is going to meet the standard to determine economic distress or underemployment. And so there's a formula, basically, that and criteria that has to be met. And that's what the commission does on a regular basis, on an annual basis. They have to publish this report so that there is guidance to determine whether or not the local hiring is triggered.
Right. I believe we have a map of the areas of the state that have higher and lower rates. And as you can see on this map, the darker areas are where most of the non-resident workers are hired. And as you can see, the lighter areas are parts of western Alaska, eastern Alaska, interior Alaska, where there are very few jobs anyway. So obviously that is pretty much a given. So I wanted to ask Renee again, since the governor has taken the requirements and put them back in effect, like it's only for state jobs, like a school construction or airport construction. So how many people would you have, or maybe Rebecca would have an idea how many people might be affected?
Well, think about the practical application of that. When you put a policy in place like that, you're making two assumptions. You're making an assumption that there are people to hire, right?
Right.
And that's a huge assumption. And you're making the assumption that people don't want to hire local people. And both of those are false. And so think about a public construction project in a rural area where there's a zone of underemployment. And a construction company goes out there, and you're on a short time schedule, right, because we have such a short construction season, and you're constrained by this 90% requirement. Mm-hmm. And what it means is that you have to exhaust every effort to hire locally. Mm-hmm. And that's just not practical in so many scenarios because there aren't people there to hire. So you have to go through this process, and it usually delays you in hiring people 3 to 6 weeks. And then at the end of that process, when you can prove that you can't hire people and meet that requirement, you ask for a waiver from the Department of Labor. And it would be really interesting to see how many waivers have been given, and I know there have been many, in these times when we put these restrictions on people.
And wouldn't you say, though, that many people, such as myself, who came to Alaska seeking a job, stayed?
Oh, absolutely.
And helped the state grow. Now, I'm not taking a side on any of this. I'm just saying that good many people come to Alaska thinking they're going to stay a summer. And 40 years later, they're still here. There was something else you said earlier about people not being able to pass
pre-employment
tests. Can you talk
sure.
about that a little
so,
bit?
So, in fact, we've been very involved in this discussion as the whole issue of legalizing marijuana came up. Mm-hmm. Our employers already have a huge problem with getting, typically 30% of the people who come to them fail a pre-employment screening, and it's usually a drug test they can't pass, or they've got a felony on their record, or fit for duty. So, again, you know, when you're looking at the 2014 report that said the oil industry created 700 new jobs that year and 500 went to non-residents, you really have to look at that number, at how small it is, and think about the people who couldn't pass a pre-employment screening, and think about the fact that we were booming and didn't have people here, before you take that as an indication that you have to have some kind of a policy that addresses that, because you see that as a problem.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the challenge, I think, with these reports and statistics, is
Absolutely.
You don't have a true measure of who are the qualified candidates that we're working from, what is the pool. And that was the biggest complaint and criticism that the U.S. Supreme Court had of the prior law that was in place, is that there was no cause and effect really established by the state of Alaska. They couldn't show that the reason why there was underemployment of Alaska residents was because of this influx of non-residents coming in there. They couldn't establish that we had a trained workforce that was eligible for the employment, that they were qualified on all the levels that they needed to be to perform a lot of these very trade-specific and expertise level jobs.
There's a great example of that in a report that was done by the McDowell Group for the Senate Labor Committee when we were debating oil taxes in 2012. And they hired the McDowell Group to look at, nobody could had a real grasp of what non-resident hire was like on the North Slope. So the McDowell Group went back and studied and did this report. And there was one quarter in the year where out-of-state hire, non-resident hire on the North Slope was significantly higher by like 12 percentage points in that quarter. And when they went and looked at that, what they looked at is that one of the companies had hired a firm out of Texas who brought up 100 people for about 4 months to do a very specialized job that we didn't have anybody qualified in the state of Alaska to do. And so again, making the assumption that people, that we have the people here to do a job and that people don't want to hire locally usually drives these things. And mm-hmm. and so we have to look at those assumptions and see if they're accurate.
Right. And I was just going to say Renee here, is there a definition of resident? Is that anywhere on the books? I don't know it. I didn't find it. It did come across the reading I was doing up on this. But who's to say who's a resident? It's like the PFD where you have to live here. Mm-hmm. But you just the year required, the one-year residency requirement was struck down by the courts back in the 80s.
The one-year requirement was struck down, but a 30-day requirement has not been struck down.
Okay.
So that's where it is. And I think most employers, I agree with you, most employers want to hire locally because the statistics of turnover are less, because if you have someone who's already familiar with the terrain up here, with the weather, with the long hours or the conditions of working up here and the different other nuances that come along with living up here in Alaska, they're already familiar with those and they don't have as much of an adjustment. And starting a new job is an adjustment enough, but when then you also change the complete dynamics of where you're working, that also is a challenge. And plus, there's also a law in the books that requires if an employer hires someone from out of state and brings them here for work and then terminates their employment, they have to pay for their return transportation out of the state. No employer wants to take on that financial risk as well.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely an increased cost. Yeah. You know, when you're in the construction industry and you think about, you know, the Department of Labor wanting to have this requirement on public construction contracts. If you're a construction company and you hire somebody and you take them somewhere that's a certain distance away from their home, you have to pay them per diem. So there's a significant increased cost for people to hire people who aren't local. So again, assuming that people don't want to hire local is an incorrect assumption.
Right. And I was just getting back to the training aspect. I think the larger corporations anyway are anxious to help with training programs. Look at the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program at UAA.
Right.
That has just mushroomed over the past few years, and it's totally, you know, not totally, but very prominently supported by many of our largest industry groups, and it's been very successful. I think that I can't say specifically to myself, but it seems to me there's training everywhere you look, if you're looking for it.
There is. There are so many opportunities for training.
So I was getting to the seasonal thing, according to what I've read anyway. I'm not a lawyer, but I did read the Alaska Law Review on this. And there's a seasonal aspect to Alaska hire. Apparently, if the state unemployment rate is higher than the national average by a certain percentage, then certain requirements can kick in. But our unemployment rate is so affected by our seasonal nature of some of our industries. Can you comment on that?
Well, seasonal and economy driven. Right. You know, this is a 2014 report, and now we're in the second month of 2016, and what a dynamic change to our industry. We're laying people off.
Right.
I mean, our members are hemorrhaging.
Right.
And so even in that report that showed, you know, 14,600 workers in December of 2014, at the same time in 2015 shows 1,000 jobs lost. And that's just their estimate. They don't have the final data on that. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, it's interesting that there's a seasonal impact that could kick in a change, but not an economic one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what to say about that.
Well,
again, you know, especially now taking that data from 2014 and applying it to the economy that we have now.
It's drastically different.
Drastically different.
2015 was the hinge where everything went from.
Absolutely.
Bingo. According to, and now, that I'm glad you, perfect segue here, the Labor Department's magazine Trends just came out this week. I think yesterday I saw it. And it defines recession, or attempts to define recession. And it says basically in this article that a recession has to be counted at the last quarter of the previous year. Mm-hmm. And you know, so if we are, and it was not definite about this, that if we are in a recession here in the state, it began in the last quarter of 2015. Mm-hmm. And again, although oil prices declined steadily from the December of 2014 through last year, I think there was a lot of hope that it would not last as long as it has. So how are we coping? I mean, you're saying your industry, Rebecca, is laying some people off. So is this non-resident hire report coming out at an appropriate time?
I honestly have to say it's not meaningful at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, the policies that the Department of Labor in our state should be looking at is what do we need to do to promote job growth in a downturn, right? So like you said, we've all been through this and we know it's going to change, but what we should really be doing is thinking about what policies do we need in place right now that keep the private sector strong in a downturn and that promote job growth. And so I just don't see how that report is even meaningful. And even, you know, that report, and on their website, you'll see they have at least a 6-month lag time on job data because of the data that they collect. Mm-hmm. And so they haven't even finalized what the fourth quarter is for 2015 yet. And I think the numbers will drastically change for them. But it's not meaningful in our industry. You know, what we're looking at is how do we keep investment in this state that creates jobs when oil prices are in the tank.
Well, obviously this report is about money and where it's being spent. There was a lot of data about how much seafood workers make, how much oil field workers make, percentages of resident, non-resident. But I think the total was something like, again, it was not targeting any one particular industry, but, okay, quote, wages paid to non-residents in the seafood industry were $257.8 million, and that is as of 2014. And that money went out of the state, and that is sort of the between the lines information here. But where is this going? I mean, why do they want to keep this money in the state? Obviously, the trickle-down effect helps jobs, but I think it's going more toward a administrative policy.
Well, people get excited when they see money leaving the state, as they should. You know, we should be thinking about that, and especially at this time where we're facing such a huge budget deficit, and one of the things that we're considering is an income tax. And when people look at oil and gas jobs, they're the highest-paying jobs in the state, right?
Right.
Well over six figures for a large percentage of our jobs. So when people think that a significant amount of money is leaving the state in that industry, they really want to look at it. What I'm saying right now is we're laying people off.
Right. Exactly.
We're not hiring people who are taking money out of state.
It's a bit backwards, according to the report.
Right.
Yeah. Oil field services employees, 36% are non-resident, and they take something like $421 million and change out of the state. But is that not their right?
You know, an interesting part of that 36% is that the McDowell Group identified when they did their study that 12% of the out-of-state people were people who had lived here in Alaska for 30 or 40 years and had decided to move elsewhere but had been residents here.
Right.
12%, that's a big number. So they had lived here and then moved somewhere else, but were still working in the industry here.
And again, under the United States Constitution, and it's a pretty tough nut to crack there. One state is as good as another, and you cannot afford protections between different states. It's just not done. So, and that has my and this is directed toward Renee. I did read that article in the Alaska Law Review, and it traced the growth of these local hire initiatives or attempts, anyway, from the TAPS line back in the 70s through up to the 90s. And were there precedents set at all in these Alaska court cases? It was interesting to me that the Alaska Supreme Court upheld the laws, whereas the United States Supreme Court said no.
Well, they upheld it to an extent. They did strike down that one-year residency requirement. But no, I mean, I think Alaska is the first state that really led this movement towards local hire. However, there's states and local municipalities and counties throughout the country that have tried to modify a local hire law right. in such a way that it would pass the U.S. Constitutional test, and with varying results. I mean, some places have been able to develop incentives so that right. if an employer does meet a certain local hire percentage, that they receive a bonus payment on a project, or they get a discount on certain from certain vendors. And those seem to be, so far anyway, they've been held constitutional, but there's still some commentary out there that suggests that they could warrant some challenge because it penalizes those people who aren't able to meet the percentage of local hire quota. But I think the precedent is you cannot have a real strict quota that's inflexible. You have to be able to have it more aspirational. Right. You have to show that you made a good faith effort and allow for waivers if a good faith effort is exhausted and they're still not able to meet that threshold that's set. So I think that's the precedent. You can't have an inflexible rule.
Well, that's my music cue. We're running out of time. Thanks to my guests. Thanks to Rebecca Logan with the Alliance and Renee Saeed, attorney. And we will be back next week with another wonderful topic. We have so much more we could be saying today, but I think these questions will be threshed out over the next legislative session. And so I'm your host, Ellen Lockyer. Thanks for tuning in.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.